to say a word about the kind of literature we're reading. It's really anticlimactic when I push the button and nothing happens. There we go. This type of literature is sometimes called apocalyptic. The last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, if you read it out of a Greek text, it says this is the apocalypse of John. So it's a particular kind of writing. And knowing, you have to kind of know what you're reading in any kind of book to understand what it is you're reading. So if you're reading a piece of paper and it says it's the bottom of the fifth and there's two outs, what kind of text am I reading? Yeah, so it's the sports, right? This is not a reference to the weather. That wouldn't make any sense. Same thing if you're reading the Bible and it says, and Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat, what kind of literature might that be? What does it sound like? It's a genealogy, and you kind of know what's supposed to come next. There's some more begats coming, and not a lot of storytelling, okay? So in the Bible, we have different types of literature, and apocalyptic is one of those. So if you read something that says, and the sky will be turned to blood and the moon to darkness, and that's not a weather forecast either. That's apocalyptic language that's describing this scene that is on display. So five rules for reading apocalyptic literature that'll get us started. Number one, apocalyptic literature is symbolic and imaginative images of a hidden world. So if you can imagine, if you could peel back the curtain on reality and take a peek what's going on behind the scenes, what would you imagine the spiritual realm looks like? Well, that's almost kind of a silly question because I don't suppose the spiritual realm looks like anything. I mean, it's not like anything we've ever seen, so what would you say? So what we get are symbolic and imaginative pictures that help convey the idea of what's really going on. Apocalyptic literature connects the present, that's the writer's present, with the future. The writer is trying to say something that's going on now will end like this. Now is a tricky word. You wouldn't think it'd be a hard word, but turns out in Bible interpretation, now is a tricky word. Because everybody wants to make now 2018, but now in the Bible isn't 2018. Now in the Bible is more like 586 BC. Okay, so something that is happening in the time of Daniel is being imagined in a way that kind of explains something you couldn't get if God just came out and told you, apparently, with the future. How will this end? Apocalyptic literature contains hope for the oppressed and judgment for the powerful. So in almost every case, and I can't think of a quick exception to that, somebody powerful is going to fall, and somebody who's in trouble is going to be saved. That's usually the story. Whether it's Israel or Romans or Greeks or Babylonians, that's usually the story. Somebody's going to fall, somebody's going to rise. Number four, apocalyptic literature challenges the current culture and institutions. So it takes something that's going on in the present that you think is really powerful and important, and it turns it upside down and says, actually, that's not very important at all. Let me tell you what really matters. And it tells you something else. Okay? And then number five, it encourages resistance. Usually, we see apocalyptic literature when people of God are in a bad situation and are tempted to give up. And so they're told, well, let me help you imagine the end of the story. And if the end of the story is good, well, maybe I can hang on a little longer. Maybe I can fight against the powers that are keeping Christianity at bay. Maybe I could be faithful a little longer. That's really the message of the book of Revelation, for example. Maybe I could be faithful because the story is going to end the way God says. So that's the big picture of what apocalyptic literature is about. There are not a lot of modern parallels. So I was in a class one time with a professor and made a comment. I said, maybe we don't understand apocalyptic literature because you can't go to the bookstore and buy a recently written apocalyptic novel. We don't write those. And he says, oh, sure we do. And I said, like what? He said, science fiction. Science fiction is a story that somebody made up about things that he imagines might happen in the future, but he's actually trying to tell you something about going on now, right? So just go with me down this rabbit hole. The initial seasons of Star Trek, okay? So you have the Enterprise, and who are the crew members? You have, and this is, what year is this? What decade? 60s, okay? We have a black woman who is an officer. We have a Russian officer. We have a Japanese officer, all serving on the same spaceship. Well, he was trying to make a political point in the middle of the Cold War, in the middle of civil rights discussion and all that going on. He imagines a future where everybody gets along and they're all on a spaceship flying through space together. Okay. That's not exactly what Daniel is doing. Let me be fair, okay? But the principle of telling an imaginative story in order to convey something that you need to know now is the basic idea, with the difference being, instead of from Gene Roddenberry, it's from God, which makes it more important. Okay? That's the basics. Let's dive into chapter 7. We get monsters. 1 through 8. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. So where are we? In the book of Daniel, we would be back in chapter 4 or even a little earlier. I don't know what year we're in. We're at the end of Belshazzar's reign in chapter 4. So this would be before that. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear, it was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to him. And this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Everyone understand that? Good, let's move on. It's definitely a different kind of literature. This is not reading John and Jesus went down to Capernaum. it's not straightforward in that sense. It is strange. We're no longer in chronological order. This is simply a vision that he had. There are some big picture images in it, starting with these creatures arise up out of the sea. This is something that happens if you study Revelation. There's some things going on with the sea in that book too. In the ancient world, especially in Babylon, the sea was thought of as a place of chaotic power. If you're a land dweller, you thought the sea is a crazy place to be. Susan and I agree. No one should be over the water. That's just not allowed. Dangerous out there. So that's the idea of chaotic powers. In the Psalms, when it wants to say how great God is, it'll say something like, He controls the roaring seas. Right? He is master of the chaos. But for other ancient peoples, like the Babylonians, even their gods were afraid of what was in the seas. The bad monsters were in the seas. Leviathan was in the seas, you know, weapons of war. And so it's the sea is the home of great monsters. Psalm 74 says, yeah, there's critters out there. We don't know what they are, right? It's dark and mysterious down there. Who knows? And it mentions, you know, Leviathan and other things. We don't know exactly what Leviathan is referring to, but scary big things down in the deep sea, okay? God is the master of it all in the Psalms. But how did other, this is Duguid's commentary. He says, such creatures are therefore not merely PG-13, like the dinosaurs out of Jurassic Park. They are R-rated, like the vampires and evil zombies of the most chilling and disturbing horror movie. These images, he's not talking about them being vile and reprehensible in that sense, immoral, but he means they're supposed to be scary images. It's supposed to be, this is a nightmare. He calls it a dream, but before the chapter's over, he says, I was deeply disturbed. What kind of dream is it when you're deeply disturbed when you wake up? It's a nightmare. He's seeing monsters coming up out of the sea, and he describes them. Okay? There's the first one is some kind of lion, but not just a lion with wings. Because lions aren't scary enough on all fours. Let's let them fly and attack us from the sky, right? Well, this is a terrifying monster. It's an unclean mixture of animal and bird. And then somewhere at the end of what he sees, the wings are even peeled off, and it starts to stand up like a man. And so now it's a smart lion. I mean, what kind of creature is this? This is the stuff of a horror movie. It's terrifying. And as soon as that one's there, pop comes another one. There's a bear. The bear is described as lopsided. It's lifted up on one side. It's the hunchback of Notre Dame. It's this creature who's it's a deformed bear. And whatever it ate last, three ribs are hanging out of its mouth. And some voice says, eat some more. Arise and eat. Devour. Consume. So this is this hungry predator monster, a bear. And then as soon as you see the bear, because bears weren't scary enough, now it's a deformed, hungry bear, right? As soon as that's gone, up comes a third one, a leopard. Okay? Top of your head, when you think of a leopard, what attribute does a leopard have? Huh? Grace and movement and speed. Speed, they're fast. So of course, we're going to give it four sets of wings so it can go faster, right? If it couldn't catch me already, we're going to give it four sets of wings so it can go fly anywhere and go as fast as it wants. Oh, and four heads so that I can't hide from it, right? It can look in all directions. I can't even sneak up on it. So are these terrifying creatures so far? Deformities of nature. Terrible things coming up out of the sea. And then the fourth one is the scariest yet. And what is it? Nobody knows. It's just a beast. These other things at least resembled something he had a name for. The last one sounds like it's out of an H.G. Wells book. It's this terrifying monster with iron teeth that smashes to bits anything that it comes across. It has 10 horns, and then one of the horns apparently gets a mind of its own and takes over and starts talking. Okay? So at this point, are we all in agreement? This is a strange dream. Whatever he ate for dinner, don't ever eat it again. But as it turns out, this is a message from God. What do these things mean? Well, Daniel asked that question. One of the nice things about chapter 7, before you get to the even more difficult chapters, is that Daniel's going to ask all of our questions for us of an angel. Much like in the book of Revelation, at certain important moments, there is an angel standing by who says, let me tell you what that means or what you should know. So read verses 15 through 18. I am on purpose skipping verses 9 through 14. We will come back. Verse 15 and following. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious. Who has a word beside anxious, by the way? Grieved, distressed. Huh? Troubled. Whatever word you use for when you wake up from a nightmare, that's the word. He says, I was upset. I woke up. I was disturbed. Or maybe he hasn't woke up. if you wake up from a dream and you haven't woke up yet, he says, my spirit was disturbed. And yet I wasn't even done because here comes an angel. The visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. Oh, that's great. Someone's going to interpret it for us. That's exciting. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. That interpretation disappointing to anybody? Does that answer all of your questions now? Interesting that the angel doesn't tell you a whole lot of information. There was a lot more in that dream than the angel explains. The point of the dream, according to the angel, is not to correctly identify who these four beasts are. And that's hard for me because I would like to speculate an answer. I think I have a really good answer. But the angel says, that's not the point. It's four kings. Let's move on. The point the angel emphasizes is that these are kings of the earth. There is evil in the world, and it comes in many ugly forms. Four kings, four beasts, moving on. But the important part of the dream is the part that we skipped over, that these images are defeated. And that's the part the angel emphasizes. The people of the Most High survive the monsters. Okay. Concerning the images themselves, we might think, this is just a thought, all evil is a reflection of the image of Satan himself. And these beasts just are different renditions of evil in different human forms. But they all look malformed and ugly because they're not made by God. These are monstrosities. These are Frankenstein monsters. Things that men have made. Evil on the earth. Instead, we're supposed to focus on the victory of God over the beasts. Now, if you're like me, you're still not satisfied. You want to know more, and so does Daniel. So, Daniel says, "Then I desire to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things that seemed greater than its companions. And as I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom." So to get that, Daniel says, "I had a question." He says, "You skipped a bit." He says, "I want to know about the horn and the big horn and the little horn and the overthrowing of the horns. I want to know about what all that's about." Well, that was my question too. There was a whole lot of detail there, and I want an answer. So Daniel spells it all out for the angel, and here's what the angel said. He says, "As for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones. He shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High. He shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the most, people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." So what's the angel's answer? He still doesn't actually tell us a lot that we didn't already know. He says, well, it's a king. Well, there are 10 horns. Yeah, he says there's 10 kings. And one of them speaks evil and does something to the other to some of the others. And he just doesn't spell out a lot of details. So what we do, if you pick up commentaries on Daniel, they get out the history books and they say, what part of history does this fit on top of? And normally when I teach Daniel, that's what I do. I may do it yet, but not tonight. There's another chapter where it makes more sense to do that. What I want to do tonight is just point out the angel says that's actually not the important part of the dream. The whole point of the monsters is that they lose. They're scary and they lose. So you wondered about the fourth one? He says, sure, I'll tell you about the fourth one. It's different from all the rest, and it loses too. So the angel refuses to give detail, just simply calling them terrible kings. Several interpretations are plausible, but the angel refuses a specific answer in order to press the main point. The horns and the beast aren't the point. We were supposed to fix our attention on the victorious God. And at last, having tried twice now to get the angel to cough up some more detail, in verse 28, Daniel says this. Here's the end of the matter. "As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." He was wanting the angel to kind of explain away the nightmare. What about that fourth beast? That was scary. What is that? And the angel says, yeah, it's terrible. But you missed the point of the dream, Daniel. The point of the dream is that all these beasts fall in all their deformity to someone who rules above them. And at the last, Daniel says, I was alarmed. What's that mean? My color changed? What's that mean? turned pale. Yeah, I mean, you know, he woke up and he was pale. He was frightened by what he had seen. He says, but instead of shaking my fist at heaven and saying, tell me more, he said, I kept it to heart. I just took the dream for what I was allowed to know about it. I took it to heart. So tonight, we're going to try to read this like Daniel. We have the advantage because Daniel lived looking forward at these events. We can get out a history book and say, are there some events like this? And again, in future chapters of Daniel, we may do a little bit of that. But tonight, just think of it as Daniel. Daniel didn't actually get to know, in this scene, what it was all about. All he knew was, right now you're in the first year of the reign of Belshazzar. Is he going to reign forever? He's just one of many terrible beasts. And Daniel, bad news, they are going to get worse. You think the one you're with is bad? They only get worse from here. All of them are terrible in their own way, and all of them fall. Ultimately, your God wins. And that was the message of the dream, for which we turn back to the bit we skipped. Let's look in verses 9 through 12. As I looked, thrones were placed. Now this is, to get back to, this is in the dream. After he's seen the four beasts, then he sees this. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season at a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. This is the part that the angel points to and says, that's what the dream's about. The beasts are interesting, but you're missing the point. Go back to the courtroom scene. So in this scene, the beasts, if you just saw them, if you were watching a movie and this beast comes out, you'd think this is the villain. This is the most powerful being we're ever going to see. And fair enough. If one of these was in your front yard, you should run in terror, right? But in the dream, these aren't the most impressive things to be seen. It pivots to this other scene where there's this other being. The Ancient of Days, okay, there's thrones placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. So a being who sits on a throne. Did any of the beasts have thrones? They just ran amok like wild animals. This king is dignified, and he sits on a throne. He's called the Ancient of Days. Now, all these other beasts, they came up, and then they went away. And they came up, and they went away. But here is someone who has been here long before them, and will be here long after. He's the one who's actually in charge. What does he look like? Is he a deformed animal? Like these beasts? No, he is human-looking in a sense. We recognize, you know, things that might be features, a person sitting on a throne. But all of the descriptions are not human at all, are they? Everything is perfect and pristine. White as wool. Fire comes out from his throne. I mean, this is pure and unbridled power. Okay, not deformity, not a monster in a movie. This is actual regal power enthroned. And he has thousands who serve him. Ten thousands of thousands, right? Countless number that recognize his rulership, compared to the beasts who were fighting over the scraps on the earth. And he sits in judgment and opens the books. Who gets to sit in judgment and open up the books? The judge does. Yeah, God is the judge. And the judge, who's on trial? The beasts. These beasts thought they could go and do whatever they wanted. And then they met someone more powerful than them. Better by more than we can count. And he simply sits down on his throne. No thrashing about. Just simply sits down. Quietly opens up the books. In judgment. See how this is trying to show you kind of behind the curtain. The hidden world. All Daniel could see was, here's Belshazzar and his power and his empire and his armies. And he was replacing the last king who was just the same, only this one's a little worse. The world's gone mad. And he gets a dream from God that says, well, sure, the world has gone mad. It's going to keep going mad. Deformed monsters run over the earth. But the God in heaven sits on his throne and he opens up the books and he ultimately makes the calls. He ultimately makes the decisions and the judgments. What happens in his judgments? Verse 11, Daniel says, I looked because the speaking horn, whatever he was doing, you know, Daniel's really interested in that horn. He asks about it later. He's speaking. Apparently, he's speaking out in a way that would defy the one who's most high. Do his words amount to much? No. The one on the throne simply, well, it doesn't even say what he does. The horn is just speaking, and then he's dead. One on the throne opens up his books and sits in judgment. Loudmouth over here is rattling off about how great he is, and suddenly, gone. The dreadful beast that was worse than anything that had come before it, gone. The other beast that had empire and dominion, taken away. Gone. And there's not even a headsman. There's not even an execution. There's not a battle. I mean, don't we want that? Wouldn't that make a great movie? There were these terrible monsters, and then there's a battle in heaven, and this heroic angel slays them, and God wins. That's not how it happens. It's not a battle. It's a courtroom scene. It's a sentencing. God just sits down and says, guilty, and it's over. This is a God who is not to be defied. And then in verse 13, someone else comes. So let's pause a moment. We've got two kinds of beings so far. We've got monstrosities, deformed beasts who represent terrible human kings and governments. We have the Most High who sits on a throne. And then for the first time, someone comes up to the Most High. And what does he look like? Verse 13. Son of Man. If you were around for our Christology class we did a quarter ago, I think, we talked about the phrase Son of Man and its meaning and how often in the New Testament it is applied to Jesus. The phrase Son of Man is the most common phrase Jesus used to describe himself. I think pointing in this direction. In this story, we don't know any of that yet. Daniel can't read the New Testament. It hasn't happened. But what he sees is someone like the Son of Man, someone who looks human. A deformed human, a flying lion bear monster. No. Someone who looks like us, comes up to stand before the king in all his glory. And what's going to happen to him? Now pause a moment. If this king is so dreadful and powerful that just by opening up the books of judgment, he ends the reign of the terrible beasts, does this man stand a chance? So if you don't know who it is, and remember, you don't. Pretend you're Daniel for a moment, and don't think, oh, this is Jesus. Right? You're cheating. You're getting to the end. Just, he sees a dream, and all these terrible beasts are slain and taken out of the way, and then some human comes? And what is going to happen now? Well, he doesn't stand a chance. This judge is powerful. But in verse 14, the judge gives to him dominion, glory, a kingdom. All people, nations, and languages should serve him. That Aramaic word there, this is a section in Daniel that's still written in Aramaic, and so it's a little tough. Most of the translations say served. The NIV actually has worshipped. Whichever way it is, every time the word is used, it is only used of deity. It's the word, it's not like I served a human being. It's a word as in religious service. Whether you translate that worship or religious service is up to the translator. Most of them went with service. But they served him as you would a god. which, remember, if you're Jewish, is blasphemy if it's not true. Okay. A man comes before the king, and all people bow to him as they would to a god. And he's given a kingdom that shall not pass away and that shall not be destroyed. So this kingdom, unlike the beasts, the beasts don't really even, or does it even say they have a kingdom? Kind of interesting. The angel has to tell you that they're kings. They just look like beasts. But this is a real kingdom. This is what a real kingdom looks like. Not a wild, rabid monster that needs to be put down. This is real power given to one like the Son of Man. So what this says to Daniel is that his people had hope because his God reigned. And he has a kingdom to bestow, even a kingdom to bestow on mankind, that it won't go to any of these beasts that Daniel had met. None of these monstrous kings that would come one after the other after the other. God had someone else in mind. And we get to wait till the New Testament to figure out who that might be. But can you imagine they're a bit excited about the idea that God has his kingdom still in store and it's not going to be like this. It's going to be better. Okay, before they shut me down because the boys are becoming insane to do the devotional, let me give you the message of the vision overall. Basic summary. All powers of this world are being put on notice that they are not supreme, and therefore will face the Most High's judgment. Even the phrase Most High. You might be high, you are not Most High. Every king, every government is mostly a deformed monstrosity that wishes it could rule the world. And God says, no, no, no. God himself is in charge. One greater than all beasts will rule all peoples. That God does have a ruler in mind. But it's not Nebuchadnezzar. It's not Belshazzar. And Daniel, I know you're curious, and you're not going to find out quite yet, but it's not even whoever comes next. It's not even whoever comes after him. And there might be four different beasts, and there might be 10 horns on the fourth beast, and there might, it's not even them. But when you know it, you'll see it. Because it won't be a beast or a horn on a beast. It'll be one like the Son of Man. It will look like a being made in the image of God, not a deformity struggling for power. We might even say that the book of Revelation finishes the image by telling us that ultimately, even later incarnations of these beasts and the deceiver who is their true Lord will be judged. Let me just read quickly this section from Revelation 20:7 through 10. And again, without prying for details, just listen to it and see if it doesn't sound like the end of the same kind of dream. And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations that are the four corners of the earth, which is, by the way, what Daniel mentioned early on, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. Their number is like the sand of the sea. And they marched up over the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. But fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Who wins? Not the beasts. Not the monsters. Not the one who empowers the monsters. But the God of heaven. God's people are told by the angel to turn our eyes to the Son of Man, appointed by the Most High to rule all things. You know the song, "The Sands of Time Are Sinking"? I always think of this line in this chapter of Daniel. The king there in his beauty without a veil is seen. It were a well-spent journey, though 7 deaths lay between. The Lamb with his fair army doth on Mount Zion stand, and glory, glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land. There were hard times ahead for Daniel and all his people, just like there were for the people who read the book of Revelation, and maybe for us. But the end of the story is the king there in his beauty, victorious over all. Okay, that's it. Next week, we'll dive into chapter 8.